Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.
Welcome once again to Inside the Game. We get to talk sports right here on AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in your Orlando. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and we're always so pleased when you join us. Jeff Sennis does our engineering, gets us on the air. Andrew Hurd Liska, the producer. And I want to introduce you to Thomas Settles. He's the University of Georgia football team chaplain. He's got a book called Better Together, 15 Encouraging Messages from an Unforgettable Season. Thomas, so nice to hook up with you, and welcome to Orlando.
Awesome. I am super excited and thankful for this opportunity, my brother.
Thomas, tell me this. What is the role, what is the job, what is the mission of a football team chaplain?
Yes, I always let people know that I feel like I have a threefold kind of responsibility or opportunity to be with our guys. First, we really want to just have the commitment to serving the head coach. We see ourselves as an extension of the coaching staff. So I tell folks that in any organization, find out where the leader is going and support that. And so we want to be an extension of the coaching staff and support our head coach, our AD, also the president of the university. Also, after just kind of having a mindset to support the coach, we want to serve the players. That is connecting with them in terms of life away from home. There are a lot of first-time college students. There's a big transition to go from a really small pond to a big pond. So we want to look for just tangible ways to serve and encourage our players. That could be me drawing from some of my past experience playing football in terms of how to study my playbook. That could be talking to the guys about academics, or that could even be something as simple as helping guys move into the dorm. Or a couple of years ago, I had a guy who he didn't know how to drive. So actually, you know, I taught him how to drive. We picked a parking lot on campus that was empty, and I taught him how to drive. And, you know, after, you know, supporting the head coach, after serving the players, and then I feel like I have an opportunity where we earn a right to share the truth. And we want to share the love of Jesus. We understand that where we are, everyone is not a Christian, but we want to make sure that even those who may not traditionally agree with the message of Christ still can honor our presence by just connecting with them, loving on people. And I really, really enjoy just those three things, serving our team, supporting our head coach, and then just sharing the love of Jesus across campus.
Thomas, I want to dive into this book of yours, Better Together, 15 weeks, 15 messages. The first one is called Mindset, We Are Better Together. What are you writing there?
So what I do every year is I get with our head coach and I try to figure out how do we tailor our messages that will pull in the same direction as our head football coach. So our coach, Coach Smart, a couple years ago started something called Skull Sessions. And basically the Skull Sessions allow us to have like-minded vision and values. So essentially I took the Skull Sessions that were put together by a phenomenal sports psychologist by the name of Drew Brennan. And our entire organization went through it. But I saw it as a real opportunity for us to be able to talk about those things that we value from a spiritual perspective. So when we talk about mindset, one of the things that we agree with, or we are convicted of, is that we are better together. So as we started the football season in 2021, my first, of course, championship season, one of the things that our head coach wanted us to really rally around was this idea of we accomplish more together than separate. And if the team could buy into that concept, we really felt like we could accomplish way more together than we could separately. So the book kind of opens up with the mindset that we want to operate and begin this journey of the 2021 season with the firm conviction that we are truly better together.
Week two, you call it Knowing Why.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about it.
And so during our school sessions, again, we really had an opportunity for each guy to kind of write out their why, you know. And it's amazing that when guys discuss their why, it's not NFL, it's not a certain car or a certain draft grade. Usually our why is connected to something intangible, like a family member or, you know, someone who has done something for us. So taking the opportunity as an organization to hear everybody's why really helped guys connect at a deeper level. And so when I approached the chapel, I really felt like it gave us an opportunity to talk about what is our spiritual why. Like, why has God created us, and why has the Lord called us to be here? So that chapel really gave us an opportunity to be reminded of our purpose and to be reminded of God's plan. And I wanted to take, like I said, whatever we were discussing as an organization, I wanted to allow that to lead us into a deeper spiritual conversation so that we could really see it from a different perspective.
Next topic. You call it toughness.
Absolutely. So for us, toughness, it's a good thing. It's actually something that our world and most people really don't want to accept. It's unfortunate at times where some individuals have kind of bought the lie that if you just pray this little prayer and you kind of give the preacher your hand and give the Lord your heart, that everything will be easy and everything will kind of be convenient. So when we talk about toughness, we talk about how most people really don't understand what it takes to be a successful football team. They don't understand what it takes to, quote unquote, win a championship. They don't understand the grind that is required to do off-season conditioning and running and sprinting. So I kind of took that whole mindset concerning like how most people don't really understand what it takes to be successful athletically, and I kind of tied it into the reality that most people really underestimate how hard it is to really follow Jesus. Like, it's much easier for us to kind of do our own thing, for us to kind of call our own shots. And I do believe there is a stream in the church today or in the Christian culture where people just think that, you know, I can kind of bypass suffering. I can kind of bypass hard times. So as believers, we want to be reminded in a very real sense that, you know, Jesus told us in John 16:33 that, in this world we will have trouble. And in that particular chapel, we focused on 2 Samuel chapter number 23. It's a story of one of David's mighty warriors and how he was willing to defend something that God gave him. So when you take that that passage in 2 Samuel and you see how Samuel was literally willing to guard the little pea patch, he had the courage to fight and he had the willingness to take a stand. When you think about it from a spiritual perspective, we really do believe that the Lord has gifted us to protect certain things. Like, we want to have convictions. We want to have courage. We want to live with commitment to God. And that requires a significant amount of toughness. And I think that sometimes we think that just following Jesus or just having faith or, you know, just going to church will allow us to skip past having to show toughness. But those who walk with the Lord and those who have faith in Christ, we grow in those tough seasons. We grow when it's hard. It's not, I think that when things are comfortable and kind of a little too easy. We get complacent. So for me, the idea of spiritual toughness is a reminder that God has called us to grow.
Now talk to us about composure, topic four.
Yeah, so we took Psalm 23, probably one of the most notable or most memorable passages in all of the scriptures, and we really talked about how Psalm 23 gives us this beautiful picture of David having full trust in the Lord. I think that sometimes we approach life kind of thinking that the Lord is waiting on us to impress Him with our performance. But ultimately, we believe that God desires for us to trust Him. And Psalm 23, in my opinion, is a beautiful reminder of what it looks like to trust the Lord. So in the passage, David encourages us to know the way. He encourages us to go the way, and David encourages us to show the way. And actually, I think that was one of my favorite chapels of the season because it gave me an opportunity to share a story about Ken Griffey Jr. and Ken Griffey Sr. You know, Major League Baseball has been played in America since 1875, but on September 14th, 1990, something happened that had never happened before, and it has never happened since. You know, at that time, Ken Griffey Sr., he had been a key member of the World Series of championship teams with the Reds, and now he's kind of at the tail end of his career, and he's able to, he has the opportunity to play with his son, Ken Griffey Jr. And on that day, in the first inning of the game, Griffey Sr., he hit a home run to center field, and then he was followed at the next at bat by his son, who hit another home run to exactly the same spot. It's amazing to me that the father and son hit back-to-back home runs, and they did something that professional baseball history has never seen again. But the beautiful thing about it is Ken Griffey gives us Ken Griffey Sr. really, he showed his son the way. So we should not be surprised that his son knew the way. And as believers, in a very real sense, we have an opportunity to know the way, to go the way, but we also have an opportunity to show others the way. And as we are willing to show composure spiritually, it gives us a real opportunity to model how to follow the Lord in every aspect of our lives.
Thomas Settles is our guest, University of Georgia football team chaplain. We're talking about his book, Better Together. And when we come back, Thomas is going to talk to us about resiliency. This show is Inside the Game. We talk sports every weekend. I'm your host, Pat Williams. It's AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Thomas Settles is the University of Georgia football team chaplain. He has written 15 encouraging messages from an unforgettable season. The name of the book, Better Together, go get it. Resiliency, Thomas, is the next topic for you.
Absolutely. We really believe that resiliency is a super important aspect of life. I think that a lot of times we allow ourselves to operate in life kind of how we operate on social media. I think most people are familiar with in some way, shape, or form with a filter, right? Like you could, you know, put a filter on your face and put a filter on the background. And I think that just how it's super easy to kind of live life trying to put forth a filter. I really do believe that if we're not careful, we can operate in a way as if it's acceptable to live life with a filter. And I really have been encouraged over the years with Psalm 13 because in that passage, David is very real and transparent. You know, sometimes in church, we can kind of have this fake it till you make it kind of mindset, and it's kind of that whole never see a sweat. But in Psalm 13, David is resilient. He's honest about his condition. He's on the run. He's willing to cry out to the Lord. And because David was willing to cry out to the Lord, he was comforted by the Lord.
Demand the standard, Thomas. Explain that one to us.
Yeah, demand the standard is a reminder that Jesus really did. He really did encourage us. In Matthew chapter number 6, Jesus tells us in verse 25, you know, therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life. And then you get to verse number 33, and he tells us, but seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. It says, therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious enough for itself. Sufficient for the day is its troubles. And for us, demanding the standard, it is a open invitation for us to be real about hard times, right? In the passage, there is a real reason why we worry. We worry because we get anxious about things. But usually, when we get anxious about things, it's times where we are unduly concerned, okay? But also, the text reminds us in Matthew 6 that there is a reason not to worry. We should not be marked by worry because the Lord is in control. And ultimately, the remedy to our worries is resting in the Lord. We're able to rest in the Lord, and that allows us to truly be at peace. So the standard that we want to pursue is resting in the Lord.
What about week 7, which is called self-talk? What's that mean?
Yeah, self-talk it's a passage that is inspired from Psalm 103. In Psalm 103, David is willing to encourage himself in the Lord. He literally speaks to himself. Now, usually, I guess traditionally, we kind of see speaking to ourselves as a sign of weakness, or we said, you know, things like something's wrong with someone who speaks to themselves. But long before any of us ever did that, David is willing to encourage himself in the Lord. He's willing to speak to himself about the reality of God's miracles, God's mercy, and God's majesty. And the more he speaks to himself about the Lord, the fire begins to burn in his life for the Lord. For me, it's kind of like, as a reminder, when you were a little bit younger and maybe you were with the Boy Scouts and you made a fire, and, you know, one of the first things that we learned is that it's important not to let the fire go out. And for the fire to go out, you got to put more wood on it, but you also got to stir it up. And in a very real sense, spiritually, David is willing to stir himself up in the Lord. And as he does it, as he talks to himself about the blessings and the benefits that are found in Christ, he's able to encourage himself in the Lord.
Help others win. Explain that one.
Yeah, so we all want to be successful. Like, there's no one who has ever woke up who did not want to be successful. But the question that we got to ask ourselves is, am I just wanting to be successful, or am I willing to help others win? And for us, like, we really believe that it is quite possible for all of us to be successful, but the Lord is calling us to help others win. And for me to help others win, it requires that I'm willing to be disciplined, I'm willing to be devoted, and I'm willing to be diligent in seeking the Lord.
Humility is next.
Yeah. Humility is one of those qualities that it's kind of hard to understand. Like, one of the ways I kind of describe humility to our players is when a guy is in the weight room and they are and they're doing squats, they always say that for the squat to count, you got to get low. Because the lower you get in the squat, the stronger that you become in the drill. And for us, as believers, I really do believe that the lower we get, the more humble we are, the more we are willing to humble ourselves, the more we are able to experience God to lift us up. So for us, humility, it focuses on unity, it focuses on responsibility, and ultimately it focuses on eternity. Like, we want to leave a legacy for being together.
Explain to us this one word. It's believe.
Yeah, but the passage that inspired the Belief Chapel is Ephesians 2. It really is a beautiful picture of grace. Ephesians 2, verse 8 says, "For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not of your own doing. It is a gift of God, not a result of works, that no one may be able to boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk into them." And for us, we want to believe in three things. We want to believe in God's grace. We want to believe that the Lord has given to us way more than we could ever deserve. Also, we want to believe in God's gift. We are saved by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. But we also want to believe in God's game plan, that we are created in Christ Jesus. We are his workmanship, meaning that we have great work to do. Like, sometimes we believe the lie that the preacher or the missionary or the big donor has work to do. But we really believe that if you are a Christian, if you are a believer, if you are a follower of Christ, that you are created in Christ Jesus to do great works.
Mistakes, the danger of drifting. Explain.
Yeah, so if you read Hebrews chapter number 2, verses 1 through 4, you see that the text says, "Therefore we must pay close attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it." I tell a little story. One of my first years at UGA, we took a kind of a team building event to this river called the Broad River, and it's kind of one of those little lazy rivers where you kind of get on the tube and you just kind of like just kind of roll down the river kind of thing. And the interesting thing and frustrating thing about the Broad River is, the only thing that requires, the only thing that is required in going down the river is for you to stop making effort, right? For you to drift, that simply means that you no longer are making effort. And when you look at our lives spiritually, if we're honest, when we see ourselves drifting away from the Lord, it's usually because we're not making the same effort. And in Hebrews 2, we have a real... we have a great reminder that we need an anchor. We see the reason why we need an anchor, and we see the results of having an anchor. And that means that our life is firm and secure in the Lord.
Tell us about accountability.
Yeah, accountability is something that we don't want to consider, but it's something that is really a gift to us. If you look at Luke 9, it's a very familiar passage where Jesus is preaching and teaching about the kingdom, and we see this miracle of Jesus feeding the multitudes with the what I call the sack lunch from the little boy. There were no more than five loaves and two fish, but Jesus is willing to do an amazing miracle with the people. Now, the issue is, the disciples, they see a problem, but they want to send the problem away. You know, of course, in that day and time, Jesus preaching and teaching, there is no Chick-fil-A, there is no Pizza Hut, there is no McDonald's. And so the people needed something to eat, and that was a problem. And the disciples wanted to send the people away, but Jesus says, "Sit them down." And now the disciples don't see how all these people will be fed, but Jesus takes a sack lunch from a little boy. Jesus took what was provided and given, and Jesus does something amazing with it. And I love it because we see a problem. There's no food, no money to buy. We see provision, a sack lunch from a little boy. But the picture is that when we surrender our lives to the Lord is able to do more with what we give him than we could have ever imagined.
Well, we've had a wonderful visit with Thomas Settles. He's the University of Georgia football team chaplain, and his book, Better Together, 15 Encouraging Messages from an Unforgettable Season, and we covered 12 of them. You get the last three on your own. Gratitude, next level, hold the ladder, and beat as one. We've got more Inside the Game. Stay with us. I'm Pat Williams, your host. It's AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Thomas Settles, our guest in that first segment, University of Georgia team chaplain, talking about his book, Better Together. Well, we go from Athens right over to Atlanta. We found Rafi Cohen there, author of Trash Talk, the only book about destroying your rivals that isn't total garbage. Oh, Rafi, welcome to Orlando. And you're going to have to explain this book to us.
It would be my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me, Pat. It's good to be in Orlando.
Thank you.
The book, you know, the book which you thankfully indulged the whole subtitle, and of course, you know, a book about trash talk. You know, I had to talk a little trash in the title as well, just to have some fun. But the book is really, I mean, it is in fact the first ever book about trash talk, and that's really one of the main reasons why I wanted to write this book. You know, I grew up child of the 90s, you know, fan of the Blood in the Garden Knicks, and, you know, of course, watching, you know, teams of that era and just sort of being fascinated by those guys who were just, you know, were running their mouths, the Reggie Millers, the Gary Paytons. And there was something just like edgy, but also very confident and charismatic about those kinds of competitors that I was always drawn to. And I always kind of understood on an intuitive level that there was something more happening beneath the surface, but I never really understood what. And so this for me was an opportunity to, you know, sort of peel back the linguistics in a way, you know, the sort of superficial language to understand what's really happening. Because really trash talk, you know, in the modern American context is something that we kind of treat dismissively. It's something we think of as frivolous, unrelated to the competition. And, you know, the case I make in this book is that it is in fact a topic that's worth taking very, very seriously because it is really the language of competition and it has existed throughout time and across cultures. And it is just part of how we communicate with one another when we are competing, when we're going head to head.
Your first chapter, Look Who's Talking. That's how you dive into this book. Tell us about chapter one.
Chapter one really for me was about, you know, setting the stage of that, of the idea I was just talking about, that, you know, trying to unexceptionalize this idea of trash talk and trash talking. You know, within the modern American context, you know, trash talk is actually a relatively new term. The first time that I could find it being used in, you know, in any kind of, you know, magazine or newspaper was in 1981 in the Washington Post. That is the first time that the term trash talk was printed. And, you know, from that time on, you know, it sort of steadily gained in popularity up until, you know, around 1993 when there was an explosion of use of the term trash talk. And we had all these trend stories being written about the practice in publications like Sports Illustrated and the New York Times, and you would have, you know, NBC studio shows, you know, pregame or, you know, halftime talking about trash talk in basketball, and it was really looked at as this brand new thing that, you know, that had never existed before. But that's really not true. It's more that the term was new. You know, we have trash talk going back all the way to the Bible and the Homeric poems, and you can find, you know, Greek invective poets, and there was all sorts of trash talk in Roman society from, you know, from poets to politicians, and it really has existed, again, you know, across cultures, across the globe. And so this first chapter for me was really almost going into the origins of trash talk to kind of, you know, trace that arc and to show that it really is nothing new. It's nothing exceptional. And then also sort of getting a little bit into, you know, our own, the beginnings of our own understanding of trash talk, because within the American context, you know, the term trash talk really reflects the influences of, you know, Black American culture, and specifically, you know, Black oral traditions like the dozens and toasts, and trash talk, as we think of it, kind of grew out of those traditions, you know, out of the fledgling culture of hip hop in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and the style of competition that existed on playground basketball courts. And so it was a little unfamiliar to the wider, largely white, you know, American sports audiences. So for me, I really wanted to make those connections so we understood that this kind of mode of communication, while we might not recognize it everywhere we see it, it is something that's deeply ingrained and part of who we are.
Second topic, the business of trash talk.
Indeed. And it's actually a booming business. We can think about it, you know, sort of most obviously within professional wrestling and combat sports, right? You think about in wrestling, they call it cutting a promo. That's when you're in the ring or you're behind the scenes on camera and you're talking to the television audience and you're telling them about the guy that, or the gal that you're about to take on, and sort of what you're going to do to them or what they did to you last time and how you're going to get revenge. And you're building anticipation. You're building hype, right? This is also exactly what Muhammad Ali would do before a contest. And he had, you know, he would do it to build anticipation and to sell tickets, but he had other, of course, you know, strategic competitive ends as well. But basically, you know, that trash talk can be used to gain attention, to bring attention to a contest, to an event. And to me, the most interesting thing that I found here, or sort of the most fundamental that I really based this chapter on, is there was a study out of Georgetown and the Wharton School in the University of Pennsylvania that looked at trash talk, believe it or not, in the workplace. And what they found was that trash talk, quote, raises the psychological stakes of competition. And what that means is that when you start talking trash, now there's more on the line, right? You have more to gain and more to lose. There's more pressure on the performance. And what that means, like, that makes the contest matter more. It gives it meaning that it might not otherwise have. That invests the competitors potentially, which speaks to a kind of motivation, but it also invests the audience. It makes you tune in. It makes you buy a ticket. It's all about rivalry creation, right? When you start talking trash, you actually start to see your opponent no longer as just an opponent, but now as a rival. And that has all sorts of implications in terms of the intensity of that competition, you know, the lengths to which you're willing to go to win that competition. And so this really is, trash talk really is, it can be used as a tool of business. I mean, it can be a double-edged sword, you know, there, just as it can be in lots of places. But I think, in this chapter, I really wanted to get, you know, to get that across, that this is about, it's about storytelling. It's about meaning creation. And it's almost existential in that way, because, you know, these contests that we witness or participate in, you know, the Magic versus the Heat, the Yankees versus the Red Sox, like, nope, there's nothing inherently meaningful about that. They're just wearing different colored laundry. But when we start to tell ourselves stories about what this contest means, you know, in terms of personal pride or regional pride and legacy, all these things, And suddenly, you know, these become battles of epic proportion.
How about this topic? A good heel is hard to find.
So the heels, of course, you know, for those listeners who maybe don't pay attention to professional wrestling, you know, you have your good guy and your bad guy. These are very basic storylines at, you know, at the most fundamental level. And that is the good guy is the babyface, the bad guy is the heel. And this very much ties into, you know, a lot of those same ideas in the second chapter about the business of trash talk. Because in wrestling and beyond, it is the villain that drives the business, right? It's the guy who is yapping his gums who we want to see someone finally, you know, we want to see someone shut that guy up, right? Make him stop talking. And the more they talk, the more they needle, you know, the more antagonized we are as an audience and the more, you know, just thrilling, the more excitement we feel leading into that contest. Because we're, again, invested in this way, in terms of the outcome of the match, because this person has needled us and there's a lot of ways to do it. You know, you can, you know, the sort of preeminent wrestling heel in American history is Gorgeous George, if you're familiar with him. And, you know, he made us reimagine what it meant to be a heel. He didn't just, you know, wear black and, you know, do dirty things in the ring, but he really sort of poked at the nerves of America at the time. He was this sort of vainglorious beauty queen. He wore dresses and skirts and cared about the look of his hair, and he perfumed the ring. You know, and at a time in America, you know, this is World War II era when, you know, manliness really mattered. He was really poking at some sensitive areas, and as a result, you know, that people were really, really intensely wanted him to lose. So this chapter really gets into those ideas and sort of, you know, what it means to be a heel and also what it means to put on that kind of character performance. Because sometimes when we compete, you know, we need to become someone that we aren't all the time. And, you know, what happens when we do that, right? There's benefits, but there could also be downsides because, as happened to Gorgeous George, you can lose yourself in that character. You know, he actually, you know, got to the point where he was no longer, he was George Wagner. That's who he was. But he started asking his kids to call him Gorgeous, which is, you know, very sad when you think about that. That, you know, who he felt himself to be was no longer the person he really was. And so anyway, that's so I get into a lot of those ideas in that chapter. It's a lot of fun.
Here's what's going on, folks. You're listening to Rafi Cohan, his book, Trash Talk, the only book about destroying your rivals that isn't total garbage. We have another segment with Rafi. And when we come back, the first topic, well, it's a question. Are you a kangaroo? And then we go to the most critical dimension, and then the last 10%. Quite a visit here with Rafi Cohan. I'm Pat Williams, your host for this show, Inside the Game. We talk sports every weekend right here on AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. Rafi Cohan joins us from Atlanta, talking about his book, Trash Talk. Okay, Rafi, as mentioned, are you a kangaroo? What's that mean?
Yeah, this whole second section, you know, are you a kangaroo, and the most critical dimension, and the last 10%, these are all really my sort of sports psychology chapters. This is where we look under the hood to try to get a better sense of how trash talk actually works. Like, how does it affect performance? And there's a number of ways, a number of mechanisms by which trash talk can indeed affect performance. In that first chapter, Are You a Kangaroo? You know, I use characters like Gary Payton and Kevin Garnett to talk about a psychological model that's known as IZOF, which stands as the Individual Zones of Optimal Functioning. And what that speaks to is this idea that every performer every athlete or performer in any sense, has an optimal level of anxiety, of arousal that they need to be at their best. And so for some folks, that may be a very high level of arousal. You can think about, you know, a player like Kevin Garnett, who is almost, you know, in a frenzy when he competed, you know, on the court, versus, you know, his famous rival, Tim Duncan, who is stoic and calm and very seemingly placid. And so it's very important for everyone to be within their own individualized range, because when you go above it, that's when your performance can deteriorate dramatically. And so one way that trash talk can work is actually to increase someone's anxiety levels, to put more pressure on their performance, and get them to explode through that upper threshold, and in fact enter, you know, what we know as fight, flight, or freeze, right? It's when you're overwhelmed by anxiety, you have a threat response. And when you have a threat response, we have physiological changes in our body that make it very hard to succeed, you know, on the field of competition or to perform in any way. So manipulating someone's anxiety in that way can be a terrific way, you know, to affect their performance. Just as in that next chapter that you mentioned, the most critical dimension, stealing someone's attention can be, right? We have different attentional states. This is true for everyone, performer or not. You can think about it as having a very wide band of attention where you're taking in lots of information, or a very narrow band of attention where you're focusing on fewer things. And one isn't better or worse than the other, but one can be more, you know, functional or dysfunctional given the task at hand, right? You can think about a quarterback who's dropping back to pass that wants to take in, you know, the whole, you know, width of the field and understand what the coverages are and what routes his receivers are running, and also the defensive linemen who are closing in on him, and make the right decision. Whereas if his arousal goes up too much, his attention may narrow, and suddenly he's not seeing that safety creeping over, and he throws the ball and boom, interception, right? So introducing what are known as, you know, task irrelevant cues, you know, something that is unrelated to the task at hand, which can, one, just frankly steal attention, and then it makes it so that you're not paying attention to the things you're supposed to, or it actually manipulates your arousal level, as we spoke about in the Eisoff model, which has, you know, an intentional consequence, and then therefore give you ineffective attention. So that's another way. And this stuff, I get a little bit into the science of this stuff. I'm trying not to be overly nerdy here, but I try to, you know, to get it across within the chapters in an accessible way. And the last, you know, the last pathway that I talk about in that third chapter, the last 10%, is really about motivation, right? We can think about motivation being, you know, something that comes internally and we're internally driven, or is external, right? We might want to make a lot of money. We might want to have, you know, public accolades, whatever the case may be. But trash talk is a way to actually increase one's motivational level, regardless of whether you're more internally or externally focused. Because, well, for one, as professional athletes know, and I'm sure you're aware of, you know, playing these games night after night, it can become tedious. I mean, I know as fans, we don't want to hear that, but that's the truth. This is a game. And so occasionally you need to find reasons to get yourself up for the game. And in the same way that trash talk can endow meaning to a contest and draw eyeballs, you know, from that business perspective, it can also make the contest matter more for the performer, him or herself. It can add motivation. However, on the flip side, we have what's known as a failed mental model. That comes from us, from our sociological friends who did that study of trash talk in the workplace. And what they mean by that is when you talk trash to someone, the target of that trash talk actually increases their own effort. They are more motivated to see their opponents lose. And they call it a failed mental model because the person who's talking trash often doesn't anticipate that. They don't anticipate that their own trash talk, which they may be using to increase their own motivation or to get into their own, you know, zone of optimal functioning, could actually, you know, be a benefit to their opponent. You know, it's sort of intuitive when we say it. You're like, of course trash talk can backfire. But it's amazing how many people don't think about it. So, yeah, in that section, I really try to get at those kind of, like, the science of trash talk and the psychology that underpins it, that helps you understand how this stuff works. Because I think it's important that, like, you know, this stuff isn't just, you know, clickbait, you know, headline clickbait stuff. It's also, you know, the more you understand this, the more effective you can be as a trash talker, the more strategic you can be, but also the more resistant you can be to it, if that's, you know, if that's the position you find yourself in.
We move on, Rafi, to topic number 8, how to respond or not respond. And then you go from that to the makings of mental toughness. Fill us in.
Yeah. Yeah. Chat section 3 is all about that kind of response, as I was just alluding to, the ability to sort of resist trash talk. And I actually spent those chapters visiting the military in Fort Bragg and down at a special forces diving school in Key West. And the reason I do that is because their training methodologies, you know, leverage this sort of idea of stress inoculation. It's this idea of learning to perform under pressure, because, you know, again, as we were saying, talking trash puts more pressure on someone's performance. And so the answer to trash talk is performing under pressure, is demonstrating mental toughness and mentally tough behaviors in spite of the pressure of a given moment or in spite of any possible distraction. So really what I wanted to learn here, and I thought the military, you know, gave us an incredible example of this, is getting into those ideas of mental skills and mentally tough behaviors and how you can learn to, you know, exhibit those behaviors under pressure. And the way to do it is by practicing those behaviors. And you have to practice them under pressure, because as every coach or sports psychologist knows, if you want to succeed in given circumstances or under certain conditions, you need to practice under those circumstances or under those conditions. And that's exactly what they do in the military survival schools, you know, at what's known as SEER school, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, at Fort Bragg, actually at Camp McCall, which is just outside of Fort Bragg. And in the Special Forces dive school training is all about very intense, pressurized training situations. So that's really what I was getting into there, those ideas of stress inoculation and mental toughness.
Let's keep moving. Number 9. It's not compliment battle, when to blow the whistle, and a legit societal conversation. What's going on here?
Yeah, the section 4, chapters 9, 10, and 11. For me, this is the chapter that gets into ideas of morality and trash talk and ideas of sort of, you know, the policing of trash talk. It's all about where to draw the line, right? And there's a problem with the line, which is the section title, which is that for many of us, we don't have the same lines, right? The things that I'm sensitive about may not be the same things that you're sensitive about. And so there's an inherent tension there, right, about what we agree upon or don't agree upon is acceptable or not. But I really wanted to get into just some of these ideas, right? Because I don't know that I'm the arbiter of, I know I'm not the arbiter of morality on this or anything. You know, but I wanted to get into some of the tensions there, you know, showing where things do come into conflict, showing ways in which, you know, leagues and officials, you know, referees, I spoke to a lot of professional referees where they did draw the line, when they did think things go too far. And what do you do about it? How do you police these, you know, this kind of behavior? And when does it become something else entirely, right? When does trash talk become abuse? When does it become something that we should not countenance? And what are the consequences of those things? And how do we balance, you know, our moral imperatives, you know, versus our competitive imperatives, you know, to win? And so those ideas really, I think, are just in interesting and stark contrast. And I wanted to spend time talking to moral philosophers. I wanted to spend time talking to comedians, because they really deal with those ideas of the line, and referees, officials, and other folks who really, you know, live in this space. Because I think, you know, again, as we take this topic seriously, I think we should give it the moral weight that it deserves, and also the cultural weight that it deserves.
So, Rafi, at the end of the day, what do you want us all to take from this book and our chat?
Yeah. The takeaway for me is, you know, I hope the takeaway is just is that trash talk is more than frivolous, right? It's not something that we just should think about as your mama jokes or, you know, in the 90s, we saw it as like snaps, you know, these snaps joke books kind of thing, or something that we write off as it, you know, the behavior of people who are unsportsmanlike, who have, or arrogant, who have attitude problems. But really understand this is the language of competition that has existed, again, throughout time, you know, across human history, across the globe, across geography. And it is part of, it is a method, is a mode of communication. And we need to understand the ways in which it works so that we can also understand the ways in which to respond. Because trash talk is defined not just by what is said, but also by what comes next, by how we define it, by how we respond to it. That's how we give the character to trash talk. That's how we define the sort of ramifications of trash talk, right? You can think about it even in terms of something that we might think of as line crossing. You know, when someone says something that is line crossing, we have an opportunity to either push back against that or to not.
Rafi Cohen has been our guest. We've been talking about his book, Trash Talk, the only book about destroying your rivals that isn't total garbage. Thanks for joining us here on Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. We'll be back next weekend for more good sports talk here on AM 950, FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. Have a great week ahead. We'll see you next weekend. Good sports.
Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.